Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Live Well Bipolar. I am not alone in this episode. I have my new friend, Janelle, with me today, and I can't wait to get in this conversation, you guys. You know, a lot of the ways that I connect with you is on Instagram. So be able to stay connected, learn a little bit about us and our experiences. But I really am so excited to bring you guys Janelle's story today. Janelle Testa is an upcoming author of her memoir, Make a Home Out of You. She's a queer, sober, bipolar gal living in Boston. And I cannot wait to get into the ins and outs of her story today as it relates to living with bipolar disorder and navigating her journey and bringing forth the reality of what it's looked like. So Janelle, thank you so much for making the time to come out today and share this story with all of us.
Yeah, super excited to be here with you. I first heard your podcast and found you on Instagram, and I was just really excited to befriend you.
Oh, I love that. And do you remember how you first found me or listening, and then we got connected that way?
I literally searched for bipolar podcast because I was like, I want to hear about more people with bipolar. Like, I don't hear about this experience enough.
Yes. And that is the most important thing, because I feel like that's really why I started it, is to create a place for people of all backgrounds, all over the world, different cultures, whatever the source may be, because someone listening who's sitting there, right? Like, I don't know anyone else who lives with bipolar disorder. I don't know anyone outside of myself and some people I can Google on the internet, but I want to really share these stories of others to really see this is what the reality looks like. But most importantly, what has actually made the difference for me in terms of being able to get to a place where I can say that I feel like I'm living the life I always wanted to, but didn't fully think I would ever be able to get to. And that's what I'm super excited to get into with your story. So of course, I want to kick it off from the start, right? So tell us a little bit about you, your background, when you first received your diagnosis of bipolar and what your life was like at that time.
Sure. Well, I'll kick it back to like when I first got a loose diagnosis when I was 16. It was suggested to me by a psychiatrist that I may have bipolar, but he said, it's too early to diagnose you because it could just be like normal teenage angst. And I was like, okay, well, that's terrifying because the only person I know with bipolar is my grandfather, and he has bipolar 1, and it's horrible. Like he was really abusive and like really angry and really just scary. So I was like, I am going to be a horrible person like he is if I'm diagnosed with bipolar. And that was my only reference point, right? So when I got formally diagnosed in 2017, which was 7 years ago at this point, and it was a little less scary because I had more exposure to bipolar, but it was still like, oh, what does that mean for me, right? Like, what does that mean for my life? What does that mean for, because I was in a really dark place at that time. I, like you, like I've been reading in your book, I was hospitalized, and I actually had 7 hospitalizations that year. And it was a dark time for me. I had electroconvulsive therapy. I had all sorts of things going on. So that was like my initial diagnosis, and then like the formal diagnosis. And that's where it all got started.
Wow. Oh my gosh. When you talk about reading that part in my book of the hospitalization and then feeling alone, feeling that shame, and really just sitting so heavy inside of that stigma and discrimination that really separates you. And I feel like I relate a lot to what you were saying of you only knew at the time of my grandpa has bipolar 1, he's angry, he's abusive, he's this kind of person, and correlating that with me, is this going to be who I am? And hearing that at 16 years old, because I know for me at 16, I was given the diagnosis of depression. I was told this is what's going on, but I just didn't feel right with me. It just didn't sit right. I listened to what I was told, take your medicine, go to your appointments. But I just felt like there was something else going on. I didn't exactly know how to articulate that. So when you talk about you receive your formal diagnosis, 2017, hospitalization, 7 hospitalizations, electroconvulsive therapy, going through all of this and saying at that time, it didn't feel as scary as initially because I had, you said, more exposure to bipolar and had learned a little bit more about it. That to me, I feel like is very interesting to understand. So I'd love if you can expand a little bit on that. When you talk about getting the diagnosis, I knew a little bit more about it than previously. So that fear of, am I going to be exactly like how my grandpa is? What did that different exposure look like?
That's a really good question. Maybe I did have my first hospitalization in 2014. And I think that was where I was exposed to other people with bipolar. And I was like, oh, they're just like normal people like me. Like they're not my grandfather or like what I see in movies. You know, I had the hospitalization and saw others with bipolar and just, yeah, related to them on a variety of levels. And that was before I knew. And then by 2017, I think media has grown around bipolar. Like I think when I was younger, it was a lot of like just really extreme examples, but I think there's been better examples since then. So I don't know, maybe that's what it is. I'm not entirely sure what my exposure was, but I guess I just felt less scary to me.
And I think that's really what I like to try to do through these conversations is make it feel less scary by showing more people who live with bipolar. Cause like you're saying, you were in your hospitalization. I met other people who were normal everyday people like me. And it gave me kind of a face to the name of what we think bipolar is. It's only this anger, abuse, like all of these pictures that we see from TV and movies that we don't get to see when we meet everyday people who live with bipolar. I relate a lot to that as well. Cause I know for me, when I was in my hospitalization, I remember talking to a lot of people on the floor and they shared their diagnosis with me and their history. And that was the first time when I got my diagnosis. So I was in there and then I left, but still, I'd love to get your perspective on this. So you said hospitalization, and then was it the 7 hospitalizations within that same year?
Yeah. So my first one was in 2014, and that was the year that I got sober because I wish that like sobriety was just a joyous event at first, but it wasn't for me. It was really scary. And like, I was doing my 4-step in AA where you write out your trauma history essentially. And I just like, it was so much for me that I needed to go to the hospital. So that was my first hospitalization. But in 2017, I literally from February to November had 7 hospitalizations, and that was, I could not get my feet underneath me. I could not find ground. And that was when my bipolar was at its absolute worst. And I identified with your like hypersexuality in your book. That was a symptom of mine, was like sleeping with people that I shouldn't be and like, you know, putting myself in dangerous situations and that sort of thing. Like, you know, it's nobody ever asks to be assaulted, but I was also putting myself in situations that weren't safe, you know, and it's just, yeah, it was really scary. So I think there were a lot of factors that played into it, but I basically just could not get better. Like meds weren't working. Therapy wasn't working. Hospitalizations weren't working. So that's when I had to go to electroconvulsive therapy, and it helped, but it also like totally destroyed my memory. And I was severely allergic to the anesthesia. So it was like incredibly traumatic.
Okay. So much of what you said, I'm relating so much to, because when you said no one ever asked to be assaulted, that sat so heavily with me. Cause I feel like, especially when you're talking about hypersexuality, I really blame myself for a very long time when I went through my sexual assault previously. Then ended up going through a lot of phases with partying, drinking, drugs, sleeping around. And that was my way of masking and coping and keeping up this facade of like, I just need to do something. And I felt like that was my way of taking back control. If I can't decide who feels like I'm enough as a person, or I don't feel deserving of love, at least I can go out and distract myself. So, but that was my way of thinking. I was like, these people care about me. They love me. But then when I changed, like you said, you got sober in 2014. And when you do something like that and you put yourself first and you make yourself a priority, it's going to cause waves within the environment that you're used to. And that's really what happened is when I said, hey, I'm not going to do these things anymore. I don't want to go to these parties. I don't want to be sleeping with all these people. And that's actually when I met my husband 5.5 years ago, but I started doing the work like a year prior, but it ended so many relationships. And I'd love to hear your experience on that. So you talk about getting sober in 2014. And then after that, having that gap of in 2017, from February to November, having those 7 hospitalizations. And I really relate a lot to that when you're talking about putting yourself in dangerous situations, the hypersexuality, and then also feeling of nothing I'm doing is helping me actually get better. I'm doing everything I'm told. I'm taking my medications. I'm going to therapy. I'm in the hospitalizations, but I feel like that wasn't my experience. I ended up leaving the hospital and I thought going in, I was like, I'm going to learn so many tools and have so much support that when I leave, I'll be able to change my life. And really, I just started over from completely square one. So I'd love to hear from you. Did you feel like coming out of those 7 hospitalizations, did you feel any support, have any tools, or did you really feel like you got to where you are by everything you did yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like what I read in your book was that like your hospitalizations were sort of scary, like that they were, they were scary. It sounded like they were like not therapeutic experiences. And I don't know if it's where I live. Like I live in Boston where we have McLean Hospital, which is like one of the best mental health institutions in the country, that I like had a really good experience at all my hospitalizations, except for the one when I went to MGH because I had a medical thing going on at the same time. That was a scary place. My roommate told me that she killed people and I was like, okay, I need to get the fuck out of here.
Gosh.
But yeah, or that Jesus told her to kill people. That was what she told me. But my experience at McLean was super helpful. Like I felt like it was incredibly therapeutic. They were really supportive. Like I made friends there that I'm still friends with today. And I felt like it did equip me with tools, but I just like, I don't know if I needed to get ECT. I don't like, it's hard because some of me regrets it because it messed up my memory so badly, but I think it also saved my life. It's almost like chemotherapy, like where it destroys things and it heals. Like it like kills things, the good and the bad, but it also kills off that bad, you know? So I feel like, yeah. So it was a number of things.
First of all, makes me so happy to hear that you had a good experience in the facilities. You talk about the McLean Hospital in Boston, and the only bad one you said was the MGH with going through what you went through there. But I think that's really what I thought. I thought hospitalization, you're going to come out, you're going to have all these things, but really it really made that sense of discrimination and separation from what is considered like a normal neurotypical person, because I saw so much of that placed on the patients by the people working there. But it was all really hard for me to feel like, okay, what do I do now? I feel like it was just, you know, okay, are you homeless? Do you have somewhere to go? Okay, you have somewhere to go. That's kind of it. And I was like, aren't you going to ask me what I'm doing when I leave? Am I working? What is my plan or path forward? And I didn't really have any of that. But then also at the same point, I fully wasn't really present. It was almost like an out of body experience at some moment. So I feel like what you're, and the comparison you're talking about with ECT to chemo, it's killing the bad, but then the memory loss and the different things that I'm still living with today. I think that that's really helpful to expand on. So talk to me about, when did the idea first come to you, or that feeling of, I want to write my story? Because I know for me, it took me a long time. I was working on it first before I finally was like, okay, I'm going to share this. I'd love to hear what it was like for you of when that initial thought came, or was there a moment, or what was it for you that got you to say, I'm going to do this?
You know, I never really thought about it, but it started in 2017, in November of 2017, after my last hospitalization. Have you ever heard of NaNoWriMo? It's National Novel Writing Month.
No, NaNoWriMo.
It's basically like, yeah, it's basically like every November, writers around the world set out to write a 50,000 word book. And I started to write, like I wanted to get my stories down before I forgot them. Like I was really scared that my ECT had messed me up so badly that I wanted to like just write them down. And so I started to write down my stories in all these patchwork things. Like I didn't have a linear story. I just was writing things down for all these memories that I had. And from that, I was like, huh, this could be a book. and I started to put them together, and it took me like 6 years, but I did. I put them together into a book.
Oh my gosh. That is so, so cool to hear, to talk about, especially with, I want to get this down and document it, because I don't know if I'm going to remember this in the future. I don't want to try to do it later, but I think that's so cool. I've never heard of that. When you talk about NaNoWriMo and really just having something like that to like cause that spark in you of, I'm going to do this. I'm going to sit out. I'm going to write whatever I have inside me. I'm going to get it all out on paper. And then to say, I can turn this into my story. And I can tell you this from doing this podcast the last 4 years, what has actually saved my life is not only these conversations, but reading the books of so many of the authors who I've had the pleasure of interviewing and sharing their stories, because that is what showed me that yes, we all have our experience and our story, but not everyone does that of putting it in a book. It's not an easy thing. It's not, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids, but so I can't come out here and say it's like having a baby. I don't know that. I could say like whatever the comparison is, I don't know, but you're creating something and bringing it life into this world that people can hold on to and physically hold in their hands and flip through these pages and see themselves in your experience. So it's a huge deal. And I am just so proud of you. And I cannot wait to have this book and just add it to my bookshelf of all the people who've just been a big role of contributing to changing my life. So the book, tell me a little bit more about the background, because you talk about writing this, right? And you said 2017 starting, it's taken 6 years of getting it all kind of documented, put together. I'd love to hear from you if there is something that in the process of helping to facilitate bringing your story to life that you've learned from doing this that you didn't expect to learn.
100%. So first of all, the book is Make a Home Out of You, a memoir. It's the idea that I made homes in behaviors, substances, and people instead of in myself. And I tried to like seek comfort and meaning and value and worth in other places. And then I learned to find that within myself. So that's what the book is about. And yes, absolutely. In the process of writing it, I found forgiveness for myself, which is sort of something that you've been talking about too in your book, is self-forgiveness and just realizing that like, oh, things aren't, like getting raped was not my fault, you know, that sort of thing. And so I found a lot of self-forgiveness through writing and grace for myself, just realizing like, oh, wow, you've been through a lot. And like, you are not at fault for the trauma that was inflicted on you. And you are responsible for the trauma you inflicted on others, but you're not a bad person for it. And like, those are the sort of things that I've learned through writing.
I love how you talk about you are not responsible for the trauma inflicted on you, but really just shifting that aspect on what can I do after the fact? Because I feel like for me, I spent so long living inside of that, inside of the past or inside of feeling like I couldn't come out of it. But I think really shifting that focus on giving yourself that grace, giving yourself that forgiveness and really feeling it instead of just saying, yeah, that wasn't my fault or I didn't deserve it. Because I've caught myself over the years, like I've like, yes, I say this, but then I've definitely caught myself invalidating my trauma and being like, well, it could have been worse, or I could have been killed, or I could have, and I do that. And I'm like, now I'm aware of it, but before I wasn't. So I feel like writing really helps you see and helps you in that process of doing that, because so many people are going to be able to look at your story and say, oh, wow, I never thought of that. I never thought that I also made a home out of substances, other people, and things outside of myself, because I didn't feel like I could lay a foundation of a home with just me. So I love that outlook and that perspective, because I feel like it's something that in every conversation I've had of people sharing their story on the podcast have a similar thread of something like that somewhere in their story of not enoughness, the shame. Should I share this? What is it going to do? All the what ifs and the fear and those things that we tell ourselves. But I want to ask you, in the process of putting this out and putting this together, tell us, right? So Make a Home Out of You. What is something that you want people, once they're done reading your book, to sit there and hold on to after they're done?
Yeah, I guess a couple of things, but I want them to feel like they are enough as they are. Like, you are not broken. You are lovable. You are worthy. Like, that at your core, you're a fundamentally worthy human being. So I think that's one thing. But also, I think a lot of us, you know, whether you're an addict or an alcoholic or not, I think a lot of us seek outside things to make us feel okay and like make us feel comfortable. And I think that what I want people to get is to just feel like they can be okay by themselves and they're like fundamentally worthwhile by themselves. And they don't need someone else to validate that or tell them they're enough, like just that they can find that within themselves.
That's so powerful. Cause I think that, especially like you said, going back to that notion of we all have something, right? Of whether or not you are someone who identifies or has gone through struggles with addiction, alcohol, whatever that is, right? The version of that, we fit that in a box, but what do we do outside of ourselves? What are we seeking for that validation? And I feel like that's what your story is going to help, is identifying those things of what is that for me? Or what does that look like? And being able to see themselves in your similarities by saying, what things am I doing? Because I know for me, a lot of it was distraction, going out, drinking, partying, sleeping around, and then constantly falling in. And then looking back on all the relationships of why am I so drawn to relationships that are abusive? And I constantly am proving myself. I need to prove myself. I need to show I'm enough for this relationship or whatever it is. And I feel like, what are the things that you've had? So it's coming up 10 years, right, of sobriety. So I know for me, the differences I've had over the years of, I never thought I would be in this place, but I am because I did this. Talk to me about that for you. So 10 years of sobriety, where you're sitting right now, do your younger self, do you think that you would have had been able to go on this path to get to where you are? Or what is that thing that you've taken away from the experience of making that happen?
Yeah, well, I definitely needed 12-step for a really long time. I was in AA and Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous for 9 and 7 years. And I think I really needed those programs to find healthy coping mechanisms, sobriety, community, stability. Like, I think I needed those for a really long time. But in the last year, last August, I left both of those programs, and I've been able to figure out how to manage my sobriety and manage my stability without them. And I never would have thought that would be the case. Like 10 years ago when I got into AA, I was like, I'm going to be in this for life. And like, this is my home. And and now I'm like, oh, I actually can like spread out my coping. Like I can go to therapy. I see a somatic therapist sometimes. I like have a psychiatrist, and those are like great, like formal support, but I can also like play in a cornhole league, or I can like go to church sometimes with my friends, or like I can hang out with my new meetup friends. Like I don't know, my life has just gotten a little bit bigger than just going to 12-step meetings. It's like, it's spread out more, the support.
I love that, because a lot of what I hear from you sharing that is you found your purpose in your community. And that's really what I felt like I didn't think I could find. And I feel like I never would have this and be able to find those people who you can do these things with or participate in outside of what has helped so far, right? Which is going to the meetings and having that program. But now that, you know, I'm not in that, what do I do instead? What things do I change about my life and my routine? And I know that that's what I hold on to, just because I feel like it's so interesting when you first get started in the process of doing this work and getting aware and saying, I need to make a change. I'm making a commitment to myself to hold on to why I'm working on this. And I feel like you're going to be faced with challenges, obstacles, moments of going back, or whether it's with addiction, relapse, or even if it's relapse in old thinking or old behaviors or things that you thought that I don't do this anymore, but I'm doing these things again and I don't fully understand. So that's what I think is what I really like about this conversation, and being able to see the fact that you've been able to build those things that you didn't have in place. Cause I know that's, at least for me, is why I felt like I struggled for so long, is because of the way that I used to live my life. And then now, I guess, how I live now versus 10 years ago. Wow. But it's also looking at my life now, I didn't have a healthy and loving relationship. I didn't have a husband who was supportive. I didn't want that. I didn't think I deserved it. I didn't think I was ever enough to have that, or whatever that looks like, right? But I think that, again, it's the people you have around you. It's your environment. It's what you're consuming. And I think that I can see that in you, of these shifts of being able to set those boundaries and stay committed to what those things look like, but also know that you can give yourself grace, and you are, like, exactly what you're saying, enough, and you always have been. But it's about the journey of realizing that and continuously giving yourself that message. So something that I always come back to in these conversations that I would love to, if you would share your input on this with me, but and I would love to, if it's something from the book that you have, I would love to hear if that can kind of tie in with it as well. But when you think about the name of this podcast and how you found me, right? You were searching bipolar podcast. You came across me and the podcast Live Well Bipolar. What does that mean to you? When you think about where you are in your life right now, at this moment, what does it mean for you to live well bipolar?
Yeah, it's kind of wild, because I think about in 2017, I could not work. I was out of work for 18 months. I was barely functioning. I didn't want to live. And now I just got my second promotion on Thursday.
Oh,
in 2 years. Thank you. I'm like, I mean, not to make it all about a job because it's not, but I mean, mm-hmm. the fact that I can function in a job and thrive in a job is huge for me. Like I make almost six figures, which is like, I never thought that I would see that day. And so like, that's one thing. The job is going great. I love my job. I'm super happy there and I'm thriving. And then there's the fact that I live with balance. Like one of the first things I had mentioned when I wrote into you was that like, I have these coping mechanisms that keep me afloat. Like I go to yoga every Tuesday, mm-hmm. you know, I make sure I get enough sleep. I saw a nutritionist for 6 years because I needed to make sure my diet was in check and that I was taking good care of myself on that front. I like go for walks. I read books. I like have hobbies. I, you know, I have this life that I've set up for myself that like I'm living well. Like I feel like I am just living a life that I'm proud of. And I do have setbacks, like in the sex and love department. I did have a setback where I like did some shit that I wasn't proud of and I made up, you know, I fixed it and I am not doing that anymore. But like, yeah, I feel like really proud of the life that I live today. And that's mm-hmm. what it's about. And I think people can get to that point. It's not easy, but it's possible.
Oh, I love that so much. There's so much to acknowledge in that you just shared. I relate so much to what you're saying, especially acknowledging you for looking back and saying like, look, I had this period, 18 months of not being able to work. And now here I am in this job that I never thought I would be able to have, going through second promotion. And especially too, the six figure thing, that was always, I don't know, for me, that was always something that I felt like, cause I remember going back to the hospital and being in the clinics and stuff when I worked there and hearing someone working there being like, people with bipolar can never be successful in a career, let alone ever hit six figures. That's never going to happen. So that fueled this fire in me of like, I want to do this to show like that it's possible, but I didn't think I could. And now it's like seeing that in you as well. I'm just like, that is so amazing to me because that's again, breaking that stigma and that glass barrier of people who really believe, you know, people with bipolar disorder cannot do these things or it's not possible. But really, like you said, having that life of balance and doing those things to take care of yourself and maintain the work that you've done. And I think that relates to just any human in general, right? Like whether or not we live with bipolar disorder, but living with bipolar disorder, we do need to do things differently. We do need to show up differently for ourselves, but also just in general, like what do we need to do to be able to like be in a good mental space? And I feel like you talk about, you know, having yoga every Tuesday, the nutritionist, right? For 6 years, getting your diet and how that food is affecting your body. I think that was a big one for me at the end of last year. I had a lot of issues with that. It was really hard to go through that. And then managing sleep, going on walks, books, hobbies, all of this. I heard you say that. And I was like, that sounds like me right now. But that's really why I have this podcast, is to show for you guys listening, what is that one thing that Janelle has done or is doing that you haven't heard of, or you haven't considered, or you haven't tried? Because it's all about bringing forth these resources and these tools to you listening. If you also live with bipolar disorder, or if you are listening to support someone that you love and care for who does, and you want to better understand how you can get education about this and show up. So Janelle, I am so thankful for you and the fact that you're here and the fact that you're sharing these messages and the fact that you never gave up on yourself and you continue to persevere. And like you said, even though I have these setbacks and I have these things that come up, I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to work through it. I'm going to utilize the coping mechanisms I have, whether that is therapy or some other kind of tool that I've come to know. I really admire that in you because it isn't easy. It isn't easy. I mean, we're always going to have to continue doing the work just because we started it and had some progress. We're still going to have those moments where we need to do it together. So I seriously, before we end, I do want to turn it over to you to tell us, where can we go to connect more with you, to learn more about you, your story, your book, and really just be able to have that connection? Where can we go?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm most active on Instagram. It's GINELLETESTA, Janelle Testa on Instagram. I'm also on TikTok. You can go to my website, JanelleTesta.com. But yeah, find me on Instagram. That's where I am every day posting to my stories, posting my nonsense and my stories and just like of good and bad. I post everything on there. Like I post the good days and the bad days so that people know that you can have both.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it so much. And I will have all of that linked in the show notes for everyone. And please, if you're not already, go and connect with Janelle, send her a message, let her know about the takeaways from this episode. And really, honestly, too, Janelle, I want to thank you so much. And really, I am so excited for you, your book and story coming out. I couldn't be more honored to share this conversation with you and really bring forth your experiences, but not just that, what they've taught you and why you chose to share them. So thank you so much for being here and sharing this. And I cannot wait to get it out into the world.
Thank you. I can't wait to finish your book. I'm like 60% through and it's so good. I relate to it so much. So thank you for writing it and thank you for having me.
Of course. And I can't wait to know what you think when it's done. And this has been so fun. I feel like we could just talk for days and days and just have so many more conversations. And you guys too, thank you for showing up, for being here, for tuning in. And I hope that you took as much out of this conversation as I have had in being part of it and bringing it out to life for you guys. So thank you for showing up, whether it's for yourself, for someone that you love and care for. You guys are a big factor in doing that work and contributing to that impact. So I want to leave you on that note and also say bye to Janelle and bye to you guys. So bye, Janelle. Bye, guys.
Bye. Thanks.